Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Veterans Day, where we stop to consider America's biggest national project so far this century, bringing the millions of men and women who served in some capacity in Iraq and Afghanistan and who are still serving, bringing them home, making their home aware of their challenges and struggles as well as their past service. Well over 2 million Americans have been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan at least once. About half have left the military. About a third have used VA medical services of some kind. And there is this alarming stat: 38 per 100,000 of all Iraq and Afghanistan veterans using VA health care committed suicide. There's little information about veterans not using the VA. That 38 compares to 11.5 deaths per 100,000 for the general public. That's 6,000 dead veterans by suicide in all categories in 2009, about 6,500 in 2012. The numbers are quietly growing. Can the traditional veterans organizations handle this? As part of the Public Radio American Homefront Project, a radio reporting team took a look at the American Legion and the VFW, powerful traditional groups that grew out of the 20th century's two world wars. But both are struggling to attract the vets of Iraq and Afghanistan. Membership is down more than a million. More than 2,000 posts across the country have closed. Reporters Patricia Murphy from KUOW Seattle and Jay Price from WUNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina, say the Iwo Jima traditions of the Legion and the VFW are just not attracting vets from the Call of Duty generation of today.
There's this kind of iconic Americana image, and it's true, of these small posts and small towns and a lot of flags, and you know, members are always in the parades for Memorial Day, for Veterans Day. They're doing things like a patriotic essay contests. They're giving out scholarships. They're kind of quietly assisting veterans who are, you know, down and out. And they do a lot in the communities. And many of these communities are now without their posts.
And in my reporting around here or in the Pacific Northwest, I have seen, you know, the American Legion, like Jay said, quietly helping veterans, you know, in more remote areas. Up in Friday Harbor, for instance, the American Legion there is small enough so that on that very small island with many, many vets, they can offer personal service. They go out and find veterans sometimes who need help getting their veterans benefits in order. They hear about that through that very small community. In larger areas like, say, Renton, the post here for the VFW in Renton, right across from the Microsoft campus. In that location, they court that Microsoft veteran group very, very significantly. Hmm. But there are some posts, you know, in small areas that just don't or may not have that veteran population. And they're not doing very much to try to stay current.
Jay Price, I get the impression that some of the places you visited, it was like going back in time. Post 87, High Point, North Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, Post 87 probably fits some of the stereotypes, for better or worse. If you spend any time at all with Legion or VFW leaders anywhere, you'll hear them talk about kind of worrying about the stereotype of old veterans swapping war stories and cigarette smoke-filled bars. But, you know, those bars, and they call them canteens, also serve a purpose, and it's cohesiveness, and it maintains a certain status quo. These communities are all different. You know, I was in one in Virginia, in Fairfax, Virginia, that had a lot of young members. The leadership was mainly Afghan Iraq vets, and that's rare. And they run the gamut from that to a, kind of almost a famous VFW post, Post 1 in Denver, which I've not visited, but has been getting a ton of press for doing things like having art shows and bringing in younger vets and, I don't know, being gay-friendly, which is something you might not see at a lot of posts. Mm. Every post is different.
What's the young sort of military community like post-Iraq and Afghanistan in the Seattle area?
Well, you know, for a lot of younger veterans who want to be part of the veteran community for either service or camaraderie or some kind of healing, so goes the world, so goes the veteran community. We have tons of choices. Do you want to learn how to blow glass? Come down to Hot Shop Heroes. We have Growing Veterans, which does farming around here. Seattle Stand Down, which works with veterans who need some sort of assistance, getting them connected. There are tons of ways to get involved, and the landscape of groups for veterans to get involved has exploded.
Is patriotism kind of a mixed bag in this community in the Pacific Northwest? I mean, are there critics of the war among these groups as well as boosters of the mission in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely. That kind of patriotism we may have seen coming out of World War II and just the opposite, you know, for some of the vets coming out of Vietnam. There is a huge group of veterans who were not completely satisfied with their service, who choose to serving other veterans in the community, connecting them with housing, mental health services, being there in support groups for them to just reflect on their experience, an act of patriotism.
Jay Price, is this a generational thing in the sense that the Call of Duty video game generation doesn't have the same my country right or wrong approach to life and sort of post-service as the World War II vets did, and these organizations are going to have to adjust or be lost in the previous generation?
We'll know in 20 years.
Really?
There have been wave after wave of after each war, there's a wave of membership that comes in, be it VFW or Legion. These things wax and they wane. There is some suspicion that there's a generational divide here that may be at least in part fueled by the world's shift to all things digital. So there's a question of whether these large traditional groups are going to be able to make that jump to the digital world, and are they doing enough to do that? But, you know, they said the Vietnam generation, they said the Vietnam vets weren't joiners and they wouldn't join. Well, they're the main members, the main group that makes up these posts now.
Patricia Murphy is a military veterans affairs reporter at KUOW in Seattle, and Jay Price is a military and veterans affairs reporter in Durham, North Carolina. Jay and Patricia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Where shall I go now? Where shall I seal my trust now? My duties fulfilled, my tours complete. What have you for this battle-weary soldier and broken soul now? I see not a sturdy post to lean upon, nor an inviting seat to sit upon, for I have been shattered to my core, my energies depleted, I seek refuge from my storm. Does the earth become my bride, if I should be stripped of all but pride? No, I am free to walk anywhere, I am free to speak my mind. Therefore I shall travel the road of solitude to the center of my own being. It is there within my being that I will seek the new and real trust, trust in myself, and trust in the being of my solitude. For the trust that I have given others is the trust that I shall now afford myself. It's a bit of a poem from writer on Veterans Affairs Paul Newell. It's called Soldier's Retreat. Finding this kind of self-reliance and trust is a nightly ritual for the nearly 50,000 veterans who the federal government estimates are homeless after the sun goes down. People in shadows, sleeping, walking, staring. Vets have been trying to generate trust and support through so-called stand-down events around the country, which happen all year long. Here's Jen Stivers, who works with veteran families at Hope for Veterans in Morristown, New Jersey.
It's basically an opportunity for homeless veterans or veterans who are at risk of becoming homeless, like maybe people who have eviction notices or they just lost their job, to come through and get information from various social service providers, housing, the VA, get different benefits and information with the hopes that we can get them off the street or prevent them from becoming homeless.
Last week, there was quite a crowd on an unseasonably warm November morning when the Takeaway attended Stand Down Morristown, just to listen to the voices of veterans. Here are two of them.
Deborah, Army 75-79.
Brendan Ty Culleton. I was in the Navy, 1988-1994.
It meant that I knew that I might be called up at any minute to go overseas and fight. I also wanted to do it because I wanted to not become a man, but become a woman. And I felt like that would help me to grow up, which it did.
To me, it means everything. It's the most life-changing thing you'll ever do, most educational thing you'll ever do, and you will see more people and meet more faces than anywhere else in the world. You'll never do this on your own. If I was asked to go, I would go again. Absolutely. Not a question in my mind.
I'm very proud, and the military helped me, and now the VA is helping me too. So.
I've been going through the VA for a long time, since 94, and I've got nothing but to run around. And they make it so difficult that you actually give up. And I think that's very, very sad. And now they have all these campaigns and all of this, support your VAs and, you know, support your veterans and all of this crap. I went to the VA last week, and I was basically thrown out. And I was like, are you kidding me? After all of this blah, 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 you got all over the television. You can't get any help?
You don't really get told that when you get out. You kind of find out from other veterans, hey, you know, there's the VA medical care. Hey, there's people you could talk to about PTSD. And hey, there's people you could talk to about, you know, that you have a housing issue. You know, eventually you realize all the things that are out there, but it takes a while.
Health and housing. I've been 8-9 years homeless. Stay in a container. I've been doing it for quite a long time, so it's normal to me, you know? It gets very cold in the winter, but I've made it so far.
I mean, I don't really have issues with housing. I live with my daughter, so that's not an issue. But as far as medical, yeah, if I didn't have the VA medical, I probably wouldn't be able to have the health care that I have, right? Because I probably wouldn't be able to afford to purchase health care on my own.
I find it difficult to get help. I've asked for help. I get pointed in this direction, that direction, that direction, and every direction I get pointed in, block, block, block.
You know, a lot of times you kind of feel alienated because you don't really have a lot of people to talk to or whatever. They don't understand the things that we saw and the things that we did, and they don't understand, you know, and a lot of people don't really respect veterans, and that really bothers me, because there's a lot of people that they're just like, oh, you're a vet, so what? They don't realize what we did, and they don't really honor us. I mean, yeah, we have Veterans Day, but the rest of the year, it's kind of like, who cares?
Invisible is a good word. I got more information out of this room in 10 minutes than I got in the VA as many times as I've been there.
I have my green lights. Yeah, I already have them up in my apartment, yeah. So anybody who's seen that commercial on TV sees that I'm supporting my other veterans, my brothers and sisters.
It just gets so frustrating, you give up. And it's not fair. It's not fair to anybody.
Our thanks to Navy veteran Brendan and Army veteran Deborah. They spoke to us from Stand Down Morristown. And from all of us here at The Takeaway, a happy, thoughtful Veterans Day. Testy in Milwaukee. The GOP debaters continued their feuding, continued their plays to the audience and to each other last night.
Thank you, Donald, for allowing me to speak at the debate. That's really nice of you. Really appreciate that.
Jeb Bush with some icy sarcasm for Donald Trump. And when questioned about his proposed wall between the U.S. and Mexico, Trump had some choice words for candidate Ohio Governor John Kasich. B-words.
Let me just...
Built an unbelievable company worth billions and billions of dollars. I don't have to hear from this man. Believe me.
12 million illegal immigrants, to send them back, 500,000 a month, is just not possible.
and it's not embracing American values. And even having this conversation sends a powerful signal. They're doing high fives in the Clinton campaign right now when they hear this.
Let me just tell you that Dwight Eisenhower moved 1.5 million illegal immigrants out of this country, moved them just beyond the border, they came back. Moved them again beyond the border, they came back. Didn't like it. Moved them way south, they never came back. Dwight Eisenhower.
That was the extent of the debate over immigration. Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson and the other candidates picked up on the economy.
Yes, problems have gotten much worse under Democrats. But the truth is, this government has been growing bigger and bigger, more corrupt, less effective, crushing the engine of economic growth for a very long time. This isn't about just replacing a Democrat with a Republican now. It's about actually challenging the status quo of big government.
Every time we raise the minimum wage, the number of jobless people increases. It's particularly a problem in the black community.
Candidate Ted Cruz noted something that was hard to argue with.
There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible. And not a one of them is as good.
While candidate Marco Rubio and candidate Rand Paul delivered some propositions that seemed difficult to actually test to see if they were true.
For the life of me, I don't know why we have stigmatized vocational education. Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers.
But the bottom line is, if you want less income inequality, move to a city with a Republican mayor or a state with a Republican governor.
Marco Rubio eventually pivoted to his favorite topic, foreign policy. It's an issue he's been hitting hard throughout these debates.
We can't even have an economy if we're not safe. There are radical jihadists in the Middle East beheading people and crucifying Christians. A radical Shia cleric in Iran trying to get a nuclear weapon. The Chinese taking over the South China Sea. Yes, I believe the world is a safer... I know that the world is a safer and better place when America is the strongest military power in the world.
Some of the feel, some of the intensity, and some of the issues there in the debate. We go now to Cynthia Henderson, who's president of the Florida Federation of Republican Women. Cynthia, how are you feeling about what happened and the eight candidates up there on stage?
Clearly, it's election time, listening to all the different people on stage and all the opinions. But I think last night what I enjoyed most was hearing candidates actually talk about the substance of how to run our country and the policies that are needed, you know, to keep the country safe and to improve the economy and those sorts of things that Americans really care about. They don't care about the petty politics. They care about hearing for the first time, where does each candidate stand and how would they be a leader, you know, if they were in the White House? And I think that was refreshing. We'll put it that way. Not as frustrating as before, certainly.
Are you done with the wall idea, the wall discussion, or do you think that's going to continue all the way to the convention?
Well, I think that immigration is an important issue. You know, it's been back and forth. Marco Rubio tried to, you know, take some effort to get ideas out there, you know, in his role as senator and wasn't successful. You know, Jeb wrote a book on it that really showed his compassion, you know, in the history of America and how we got to where we are today. You know, it's an important issue when it comes to politics. It's an important issue day to day. I doubt it, really, you know, and especially in Florida, you can't deport everybody out of the country. They're an integral part of our workforce.
One of the issues of substance that Jeb Bush talked about, and we'll end here, is the immigration debate. And I think you could probably say this about some of the other things that were talked about in this debate and some others, that Jeb Bush suggested that they're doing high fives right now in the Clinton campaign when they hear this. Do you think the Clinton campaign is overjoyed by the way this debate went, Jeb was saying there, and just in general, how all these debates have gone?
Well, I think they have to be more pleased than the Republicans, obviously, on how the debates have gone and how the questions are. You know, they just gave her softballs in the debate I saw that she was in. So I think they always get a lot of good material for when they're challenging one of our Republicans as a result of these debates, you know, when they're going after it from a personal perspective. But, you know, what's important is we're not going after what candidate in high school would win most popular. I want the candidate that's going to win most likely to succeed. And that person obviously is going to have proven executive leadership, you know, and be able to show America that they can run a country. So I think these debates are that. I think the different issues, the immigration issues and all of them will help us to decipher which candidate you fall, you know, you want to fall behind and support and endorse as you move forward in the process. And I think these, you know, these debates are important for that. You definitely get to see the, you know, the their character and how they can address issues and communicate.
Cynthia Henderson, president of the Florida Federation of Republican Women. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
She spoke to us from Tallahassee. Some bad behavior stories now from you during your school days in advance of a discussion later this hour about school discipline. Bronx, New York. I was suspended because I was stressed and bullied, so I cut class to sit by a lake at the park. Didn't make sense to suspend me and make me miss classes because I missed classes.
I'm David Lawson from Queens. In fifth grade, I made a fake report card, slipped it in a kid's backpack as a prank, and I got suspended.
Bad prank there. Oklahoma City, I got suspended for bringing my babies to school. Couldn't find a sitter. Or Vista, California, yes, my child was suspended for acting out at school due to his autism. It took years for me to get the school to stop punishing him for these behaviors when he was unable to control his reaction to certain situations. Did you ever get suspended or a loved one get suspended for something they couldn't help? Tweet back to us. We're at The Takeaway or follow me at Jay Hockenberry. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE as well.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Changing the rules, moving the goals, call it what you will, but the U.S. Soccer Federation has this week announced new safety initiatives to protect young brains in response to their fear of some older lawyers. A lawsuit filed in 2010 has documented nearly 50,000 high school soccer players who sustained concussions that year, more athletes than in baseball, basketball, softball, and wrestling combined. The entertaining practice of heading the ball, using your head to bounce, pass, or otherwise move a soccer ball, will now be banned for players 10 and younger, while 11 to 13-year-olds will be limited to only heading in games, not during practices. Stefan Fatsis is author of A Few Seconds of Panic about American football, but he's also a youth soccer coach with a daughter on his team. Stefan loves their brains and does not hesitate to implement these rules. In fact, he was already doing it.
Let's be clear. This isn't about concussions per se. This is about subconcussive hits to the head, the unknown damage that the accumulation of those can cause, and about reducing the general risk and likelihood of blows to the head playing soccer.
And heading in this case has nothing to do with like ramming your head into another player. It's the head handling the ball.
Yes, it's specifically what U.S. Soccer is saying is that children 10 and under cannot head the ball during the game. But what it does is it keeps the game down on the ground. The vast majority of reported concussions and blows to the head in soccer occur because two heads collide, or a head collides with the ground, or a head collides with a goalpost, or an elbow, or a knee. What this does is it delays the implementation of what is an important skill at adult-level soccer until a time when the brain is developed enough to protect itself better against a blow.
Is there a classic game of, global football, soccer, that takes place on the ground? Is heading a relatively new phenomenon?
No, it's not. Heading has been part of the game since the game was invented. And for decades, players used a much heavier ball. These leather balls would get waterlogged. They were much more dangerous. They were much heavier. They were much harder on the skull and every part of the body. What you will see when you watch children play the ball and try to head it out of the air is they close their eyes, they scrunch their necks, the ball hits them somewhere on their head, the back of their head, the top of their head. It's not directed to another player. It goes out of bounds. It goes away. It's not a specific task. It is important to teach kids how to do this properly. You can do that with sort of pillow-like balls. You can do that through verbal instruction. if you can wait until kids' brains are developed, and this is the issue here that neurologists will tell you, that the prepubescent body is not a strong or coordinated enough to head properly. Doing it improperly increases the risk of injury to the header and to opponents. And kids have big heads on weak necks, and doctors call this the bobblehead effect. Because their brains are developing, their nerve cells and connections aren't fully myelinated. They're not coated with myelin, which are nerve cells, which is a substance that protects and insulates nerves and nerve cells. That makes them more susceptible to injury when they're rattled by a blow. And we just don't know how repeated blows to the brain will affect the eventual development of a child's brain. You don't know what the peak might be were it not for an injury. So I think what the medical community here is saying and what U.S. Soccer is saying, in response to a lawsuit, by the way, what they're saying is that it's not worth the risk. We can delay the onset of using your head to play this game. We can delay the teaching of it. And there is nothing that says a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old or a 16-year-old can't learn a skill to the point of expertise if they don't start doing it until a later age.
Stefan Fatsis is a sports writer, youth soccer coach, and author of A Few Seconds of Panic, about dropping into the middle of professional football. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you, John.
Is there a punishment imbalance in America's public schools? According to the latest government figures from spring of last year, black students are, on average, three times as likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers. But what exactly is the goal of such a sanction or any disciplinary action in a classroom? Defining that goal and being clear about the message to students is perhaps a bigger challenge than just keeping order in the classroom. Eli Hager, reporter for the Marshall Project, went to Mississippi to see what the practice was down there. First of all, Eli, welcome to the program.
Hi, happy to be here.
Did you find an imbalance in Mississippi?
Yes, they do have an imbalance in suspensions. They suspend a higher ratio of black to white students than in any other southern state, and the South generally has a particular problem with this.
And so what were you looking for when you went down there based on the numbers that you had already looked at?
Well, I was looking at whether the state of Mississippi and the schools in Mississippi were doing anything instead of suspensions, because there's been a lot of pressure both from the federal government and the state of Mississippi to reduce suspensions and to try to start handling discipline in-house.
So the schools are attempting to come up with alternatives. And is it each school comes up with their own? Are there practices that they're trying to implement across the state?
To a large extent, it's each school comes up with their own, because in Mississippi, a defining principle is local control, and they don't like a lot of outside meddling. So each school district will have a very different way of approaching this. But the overriding principle is that in many districts, they're trying as best they can to reduce out-of-school suspensions.
And how are they doing that?
A lot of school districts are relying more on in-school suspension, which in Mississippi takes the shape of sending lots of students to this room during the day, many times for a whole school day or two or three school days, where they just sit and wait out the school day because they're being disruptive in class. Another alternative that a lot of schools are relying on, even more than they used to, is the alternative schools, which are these schools right down the road where they basically just send kids to wait out 10 or 15 or 20 days as punishment for in-school infractions. And there's not a whole lot of learning that goes on in there.
So that's not terribly much different than an actual suspension or expulsion if you're just moving them from building to building.
Right. I wouldn't say so, but it's a way of technically not suspending, and it's a way of keeping your average daily attendance up, which is a way of keeping your funding.
Did you see any practices that were real alternatives to suspension and expulsion that actually produced an alternative where the student didn't lose the classroom time but was able to be sort of put back into an orderly situation?
The schools in Mississippi are really struggling to do that, first of all, because they have a lot of traditional practices like corporal punishment and like in-school suspension that they rely on, and it's kind of hard to change the culture and overcome those traditional practices, but also because they don't really have the resources to hire counselors, hire special education teachers, hire tutors, hire behavioral interventionists, train the staff in a new discipline program. So in a very poor state, it's hard to come up with some of these alternatives. There were some schools that were struggling mightily and achieving a level of discipline in the school without sending kids to in-school suspension, without using alternatives. And they did that by a really concerted effort to change the culture of the school from the top down.
Who was the key agent of change who you managed to encounter down there? Was it a principal? Was it a teacher?
who was able to actually come up with alternatives, or it sounds a little bit as though people are really just weighed down by a system of traditions.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that there was a lot of alternatives yet in Mississippi. I know that around the country, a lot of cities have gone to a restorative justice model, which has been very successful in some cities, particularly Boston, Denver, Oakland, California, Portland, Oregon. They've adapted this restorative justice model in which kids learn about the consequences of their actions as an alternative to suspension, and it's really worked in those places.
What would you say is the future for Mississippi? Grim?
Well, I don't want to say grim because there are students and parents and teachers and administrators who are working really hard to educate the students. And in some places, students are going to achieve and be great as adults. But on the state level, I do think it's pretty grim just because it's such a poor state. The Mississippi Delta has been so devastated by the mechanization of agriculture and the high unemployment and poverty there. It's really hard to find solid solutions to some of these problems.
Eli Hager is a reporter for the Marshall Project. He's just gotten back from a study of two communities in Mississippi. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Eli, a moment ago, mentioned that some urban schools are trying to address the punishment imbalance with what are called restorative practices. These are alternatives to suspensions and expulsions that keep kids in school and maybe puts them on a path to being less disruptive. You've expressed some skepticism about the effectiveness of suspension or expulsion.
This is Ellen Walsh from Paducah, Kentucky. I was suspended once for skipping school, and they still do that to this day. And I always wondered why, when somebody skips school, you punish them by giving them more days off. Makes no sense.
We're going to look at alternatives now. For the past 3 years, Leaders High School in Brooklyn has managed to achieve a nearly 70% decrease in disputes and incidents from embracing these alternatives. David O'Hara is principal at Leaders. Felicia Harper is the school's counselor. David said the expulsion numbers at his school cried out for some kind of fix.
Qualitative data really showed us that we were suspending a lot. We were having a lot of detentions. But then once we started to look at the hard data, we started to realize that disproportionately Black and Latino boys and students with disabilities were being suspended at a much higher rate than the rest of our school population. And I think it was at that moment when myself and our teachers realized that there's something that we have to do about this.
And there were two issues. One, fairness, and number two, maybe this isn't working.
Yeah, it wasn't as effective as we wanted it to be. And the other part is students weren't learning from their error, right? And the people that were being harmed didn't feel like there was justification or some type of understanding of what happened.
And suspensions have been going on forever. I mean, you faced that punishment, maybe you didn't get suspended, but when you were growing up, right?
Oh, yeah.
So how do you come up with something that's an alternative to a punishment that's been around for generations?
So something that we looked at was suspension is something that's been around longer than we've been around,
yeah.
Right? And it hasn't been effective with the behavior that we want to see. Coming about it another way through restorative practice, we realized that not only are the kids understanding what they're doing, but they have an opportunity to give back to the community and to redeem themselves.
The original idea of suspension was to get a disruptive person out of the school. If you're going to do restorative practice, is there the risk that there's still going to be disruption of other students in the school if the individual is still around?
Well, yeah, there's no absolute to anything, but the likelihood is much lower than when we were using the traditional method.
And I can just say with the traditional method, we would send a student home for 2 or 3 days for making a mistake, yeah. And they wouldn't do anything. They become even more disenfranchised. They become angrier. They would come back and nothing was solved. And so they would still have the conflict with either that student or that teacher. And basically the behavior was not changed at all.
So you buy 2 days of peace in a couple of classrooms and the student comes back.
Sometimes even more disgruntled.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's go into an event that happened at your school and we'll try to explore how precisely and literally, you solved it. Here is the story of two students, Justin and JP.
You know, what he did, I didn't like. So I just got up and I punched him in the head and knocked him down and punched him several times more and I was dragged away.
I couldn't do anything at the moment because it all happened so fast.
It's kind of like a lot of it's a blur.
So two kids talking about a fight they had in a documentary about what happened at your school. How did you address this?
traditionally, both of these students would have been suspended, just like any other school, for engaging in a fight. So in a situation like this, a student's just completed a week-long class on a class called a school-to-prison pipeline, and they learned a lot about the history of this. So with this particular case, we decided, and the students decided, to bring the two boys to a circle. And so in this restorative circle, students were able to discuss what happened during the event and come to some sort of conclusion and next steps.
This conference is going to focus on an incident which occurred on Friday the 11th in the library during the POL, which was a fight between Justin and JP.
Now, you know that teacher, and tell me about what she's convening there. Is that the circle that you were talking about?
So she's the circle keeper. So her responsibility is to facilitate a dialogue around what happened, what was the harm that took place, and how can we move forward in a place where that situation doesn't occur, but also there's a respect between both parties.
And how are these conversations? How do they proceed?
It's really hard for a student, in this case Justin, to come to the circle and really look eye to eye to the person that he harmed and to hear how his victim has experienced this whole situation, how other key stakeholders, how the teachers were harmed by all of this, but also discuss what he was experiencing and come up with next steps so he can repair the harm that he's caused.
Did Justin bring his anger into that circle to a certain extent?
I think initially, but then he realized that everyone that was present was not only, we were all present for him, but also for the other person. So it was a community effort in the sense that we're here. There's no biases towards anyone. What they both learned is that there was a lot of miscommunication, nonverbal, that occurred right before that actual fight took place.
Boys often do that.
Yeah.
Nonverbal communications. I know what you're talking about. Here, listen.
The circle itself, nothing in the circle actually bothered me. It was just before that. It was like the peer mediation. That was the thing that bothered me. Because like at that moment, I was like still really angry at him. I didn't want to let him talk, and I was just doing a lot of yelling. I didn't really want to fix the situation. So, and like after that and the moments that led up to the circle, I feel were like the best times, the things that really just started to fix everything.
Now, how surprised were you to hear that transformation in Justin?
He feels that he was heard. But also, if you listen to JP, he also felt the same thing. And something that we realized through like restorative practice is that the first step is letting that person tell their story, telling their version.
70% decrease in disputes and incidents, yep, at your school?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good number.
Yeah.
And as of right now, we have zero suspensions so far since September 8th.
Mm-hmm.
David O'Hara is a principal at Leaders High School, a New York City Outward Bound school. Felicia Harper is a school counselor at Leaders. Felicia and David, thanks so much.
Thank you
so much.
Fights and more from you. St. Cloud, Minnesota. A boy punched my sister and I broke his nose. The dean recommended I take up boxing and my father made me hang drywall for free for the 2 days I was suspended.
My name is Gwen. I currently live in Brooklyn and I went to high school in Alabama, where I was suspended a total of 4 times for having my flip phone out in class, tardies, and having my shirt untucked, which is a uniform violation. And somehow I became a worthwhile member of society while being suspended once a year every year.
Rocky River, Ohio. My son was suspended for acting on self-defense after he was punched twice at a school football game. It was understandable in that he didn't try to just walk away, but it didn't make it any easier. Keep those stories coming. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. As we think this Veterans Day about the wars our nation has been involved in, so many really, it's a challenge to put ourselves back into the feeling of 1939. World War II was just underway in Europe. It had seemed inevitable for some time over there. For the United States, it was publicly clear that this country wanted nothing to do with another round of slaughter across the Atlantic. But we would help our allies, and we geared our industries to back France and Britain. It was all out of fear of Germany, a fear that is easy to call up now, knowing what we do about the Holocaust. But back then, historian James Holland says in his new book, The Rise of Germany, 1939-1941, the first of a 3-volume study, he says that Hitler's military strength was actually an unknown. His conclusion is that Hitler's demise was actually in the cards from the beginning. His book has been banned in Russia by Vladimir Putin. Putin says any claim that Hitler was weak undercuts the Russian claim that it was the Soviet military that brought Germany to defeat.
I mean, I still think the kind of decision by Hitler to go into Poland on the 1st of September 1939 was possibly the most catastrophic of all the decisions he made. You know, because he was calling Britain and France's bluff, and they'd had enough. You know, they were not going to stand by anymore. And as a result of that, he went into a war which, you know, certainly on paper, he should never have won because Germany was so resource poor. And I think one of the interesting things about where we are now in the historiography of the narrative of the Second World War, World War II, is that, you know, people just assume that America entered the war kind of fully formed the arsenal of democracy, and it wasn't like that at all. I mean, it was a really long struggle to get to that position.
Well, the arc in the United States that you describe, you know, begins with ambivalence about who do we support here, to a mobilization of the U.S. economy that was so massive that it ended the Depression and created industries that had never existed before. Tell that story through some of the people who really made the decisions that we live today.
Yeah, it is just the most astonishing story, because what you have to remember, on the eve of the Second World War, America had an army that was around 189,000, which by sort of standards in the UK today seems quite big, but trust me, by 1939 standards was absolutely tiny. And I think the US Army Air Force had 74 fighter planes. No more than that. You know, so you're talking really, really, really tiny. There was no concept of all-arms combat, of sort of using tanks with artillery, with infantry like that, or anything like that. I mean, it was incredibly backward, really behind, very insular. And there was a sort of extraordinary logic to that, which is that if you have a very small armed services, then the chances are you're not going to go to war. And no one in America wanted to go to war. There was a kind of, you know, that whole isolationist thing was a very conscious decision made in the fallout of the First World War, kind of a generation earlier.
Don't have an army, don't go to war. It's funny how that works.
Right. Yeah, it does. Yeah. And conversely, the same is true. If you do have a massive army, you tend to go to war, as you guys will know all about in the last sort of 15, 20 years.
Was Hitler a pushover in your view? The Russians are pretty angry with some of your historical analysis because of the way you suggest that you know, Russia didn't have a terribly serious task in front of it.
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, you know, the war in the East is of enormous importance because that's where Germany really properly bleeds itself dry on the ground. The thing about the war in the East is that Hitler wouldn't have turned east had he not lost the Battle of Britain in 1940. You know, the worst case scenario for Germany is fighting a war on two fronts, because the way Germans fight the war is always to make them as quick as possible. It's a sort of massive amount of force at the Schwerpunkt, the point of impact. You overwhelm your enemies, you completely surround them and annihilate them. It's the principle behind the opening moves in the First World War, and it's, you know, nothing has changed. And the reason is because they're isolated in Central Europe, they're cut off from the world's sea lanes, and, you know, they're resource poor. So they have to get these wars won very, very quickly. And if they don't, they're in big trouble.
What do you think of this ban? Why do you think the Russians would be so annoyed with your book?
Oh, I don't think they're particularly annoyed with my book. I think the point about Putin banning it is that he's an ultra-nationalist, and ultra-nationalists always want to control their history. You know, every nation has its own myths about its past, and that's part of its sort of collective heritage and cultural myths. I mean, we saw this in the UK last year with the whole election, you know, the whole referendum about whether Scotland would split. Putin's doing exactly the same. It fits his own purpose of sort of Russian nationalism to big up the Great Patriotic War and kind of sideline any kind of Western analysis.
So if you look at the legacy of World War II, I mean, the United States was already the biggest economy in the world by the time you get to 1939. But you get the sense from this story and the way that you tell it that the U.S. would not have been a superpower in the way that we understand it today but for the decision to bring it into the war.
Yeah, I mean, playing the whole what-if card is always a fascinating sort of parlor game, isn't it? And, you know, what would have happened? Well, I don't know. I mean, I can see a situation where Nazi Germany would have dominated Europe. I think it would find it very, very hard to obliterate Britain, to be honest, because of Britain's global reach. So I think Britain would have held on, probably. But America, no. I mean, it wouldn't have become the nation necessarily right that it has become. I mean, in the big scheme of things, I mean, Britain and America both fought incredibly efficient wars. They fought wars which were, you know, steel, not flesh, primarily. You know, they tried to put mechanization and industrialization first and foremost and keep the number of people at the coalface of war to an absolute bare minimum. And as a result of that, you know, Britain ends up the war after 6 years of war, where it's been fighting all around the world and in numerous different theatres, with a casualty bill of 440,000. And I think the US is about 415,000. Compare that to Germany, 9 million, Soviet Union, 20 to 30 million, China, 20 to 30 million, Japan, 15 million. I mean, you know, it's in a different league.
But it's so interesting just to kind of crystallize in my mind. I mean, at the end of World War II, France is still France. Britain is still Britain. Germany is changed forever. I mean, shattered. It's the idea that Germany was ever going to be a threat in the way that it was would never happen again. Japan changed forever. But the United States also changed forever. It doesn't resemble what it was before 1939.
No, it's amazing, those 6 years of war. And it's why I think it continues to be so compellingly fascinating, because it's not just military history, it's social history, it's human drama of the highest caliber, it's economic history, it's political history, it's got so many nuances and facets to it. You know, that's what compels me to the subject. Mm. You know, 6 years is nothing. You know, how long were we in Afghanistan? 13 years or something?
And counting.
Right. But Hitler thinks of the world in terms of black and white. It's kind of the Thousand-Year Reich or it's Armageddon. When it's clearly not going to be the Thousand-Year Reich, it becomes Armageddon. And anyone walking through the shattered ruins of Germany in April or May 1945, no one would have doubted that Armageddon had reached Germany. I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, one of the most amazing stories is what happens in the years following. I mean, it's every bit as awful and tragic as the years that preceded it.
James Holland is historian and author of The Rise of Germany, 1939 to 1941. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As the GOP candidates argue over Donald Trump's border wall, we note a wall in Seattle came down. The city's Pike Place Market holds a million pieces of chewed gum, or it did until this week, when the city decided it was time to say farewell to the multicolored merging of democracy and biohazard. Men in bubble suits blasted the alley with hot germ-killing steam, and all the colored chew became gray sludge, which was then carted away. Leonard Garfield, executive director of Seattle's Museum of History and Industry, said this of the gum wall: "It went up. It's coming down. It will go up again." We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening on this Veterans Day. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.